Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Another one of Brett Kavanaugh's former classmates accuses the Supreme Court nominee of lying to the Senate about his drinking. This time, it's a professor at NC State. Meanwhile, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham issues a warning to red state Democratic senators if the Kavanaugh nomination fails. The General Assembly approves the first round of Hurricane Florence relief, $50 million, as work continues on a larger relief package. Dates are set for the GOP Charlotte convention. Book your hotel rooms. They're going fast. Plus, the Panthers make a move some say would never have happened under Jerry Richardson by signing Eric Reed. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters are, in not alphabetical order, David Borax with WFAE News. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Eric Spanberg is senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Hello there.
Good morning.
And Doss Helms is here, reporter for the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
And Glenn Birkins, editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Although the Senate Judiciary Committee will most likely vote today, moments from now, actually, on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. There was a lot of activity surrounding that nomination this week, even in addition to the limited FBI investigation that was happening. This week, another person, as I just said, came forward with something to say about Judge Kavanaugh and his character. A former Yale classmate, now NC State Associate Professor of History, Chad Luddington. He issued a statement in which he characterized Kavanaugh as a frequent drinker and a heavy drinker, and one that had been drunk to the point he could easily have passed out.
I do not believe that heavy drinking or even loudish behavior of an 18 or even 21-year-old should condemn a person for the rest of his life. I would be a hypocrite to think so. However, I have direct, repeated knowledge about Brett's drinking and his disposition while drunk. And I do believe that Brett's actions as a 53-year-old federal judge matter. If he lied about his past actions on national television, and more especially while speaking under oath in front of the United States Senate, I believe those lies should have consequences.
So Judge Kavanaugh tried to minimize his drinking while he was in front of the committee. We know he liked beer. And Professor Luddington came forward at this late date, he says, because he was deeply troubled by what has been a blatant mischaracterization by Brett himself of his drinking while at Yale. Did this become part of the FBI report? Or we don't know, do we?
We know it was reported last night that the FBI did not interview him.
Okay.
There were 11 witnesses, I think, that they were authorized to talk to. And I think this morning on NPR, they reported that 10 people were interviewed, and he was not one of them, as Eric says.
So everything I've read and heard, I've not read anything that really indicated that they did go there at all about his drinking.
So will this have any impact at all? At this point, are they just... whichever way you're going to vote, you've already decided.
Well, you would think, except there are the three Republican senators who really have not said a whole lot about what they believe regarding the FBI report.
And one Democrat is still not come public yet, Manchin from West Virginia.
That's right.
And one Montana Republican who is going to be out of town this weekend for his daughter's wedding, which throws off the vote count.
Although they may delay a vote. If they need his vote, they will delay the final vote on Saturday night until Saturday night.
So Professor Luddington, who's the professor at NC State, admitted he was often drunk while at Yale with Kavanaugh and that the judge was, quote, often belligerent and aggressive while drinking. And on one of the last occasions he was with Kavanaugh while the two were drinking, he claims he witnessed Kavanaugh, quote, respond to a semi-hostile remark by throwing his beer in a man's face and starting a fight that ended with one of their mutual friends in jail. This does correspond to a police report filed at the time that we've heard about where a 21-year-old man accused Kavanaugh of throwing ice on him for some, quote, unknown reason. This, of course, speaks to temperament, but this occurred at a much younger age, and there are those who dispute various accounts of this particular incident. So if you're a senator, how do you decide?
Well,
it's all he said, she said, or he said, he said in this case.
But I think we have continued to conflate, sort of proof versus job interview. Remember, it's been said over and over again, this is a job interview, you're trying to judge character. And so I think that the temperament argument, whether you're for or against Kavanaugh, is probably much more valid than what actually occurred in that bar 30 plus years ago, or you know, whichever of these circumstances you want to take. It gets into the temperament, and is he being truthful when he is under oath as part of this judiciary hearing? So I think those are really the salient points, but I think it all gets scrambled because it becomes emotional very quickly.
And actually, I think the issue of whether he told the truth under oath is probably the most important of all. I'm sure we'll talk about Lindsey Graham at some point, but his entire argument during the impeachment proceedings for President Clinton was about lying under oath. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is much doubt that Kavanaugh was less than truthful about some issues. We will never know what happened in that room with him and his accuser, but the extent of his drinking, that's pretty much documented, including a letter that I think came out last week that he wrote. I think he was the organizer of a beach party. And he did confirm that it was his letter, and he basically said, we need to warn the neighbors that we are heavy drinkers.
Well, there's another element you mentioned about the lying, but there's also the question of his temperament as a witness there before Congress, and whether that is affecting his ability to be an impartial judicial observer, and also his partisanship, which, at one point during his examination by the Judiciary Committee, he went on a rant about Democrats and this being a hit job and that sort of thing. And that raises questions about whether he can be politically impartial as he makes judgments about cases. And so that's another thing that the Democrats are really pushing
hard.
And
there are tons of documents that the White House has held back from his time in the Bush administration. Is that right?
Right.
Bush administration?
Right, yes.
That would indicate the level of partisanship, but we can't see those documents because they're being held back.
You know, the Washington Post this morning came out with an editorial saying that they were urging a vote against this nomination. It's the first time the Post has opposed a Supreme Court nominee since Robert Bork in 1987. And among the things that they cited was this lack of information about how he reacted in the Bush White House.
I think it just kind of speaks to the nature of the way we see and talk about things now, that I suspect a lot of people of both parties are both intensely uncomfortable with the idea that he's being grilled about his high school yearbook and his college drinking, and are intensely uncomfortable with the way he performed on the stand.
Yeah.
But it becomes, if you admit that the other side has any credibility, you have then sided with the forces of evil. So you have this
nuance is not allowed. Nuance is not allowed.
In an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, he actually addresses some of that. Mm-hmm. And if your listeners have not read it, they should go and read it. They've taken down the paywall, where he acknowledges that he said some things during the during that second hearing that he shouldn't have, and he vowed that he would be an impartial judge and all that stuff, all the things you would expect.
Right.
It was a very good letter, actually. Whether it will change anyone's mind, I don't know.
So the Washington Post has come out against, and so did the New York Times this morning in their editorial. Meanwhile, South Carolina, we're going to get to Lindsey Graham. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham has taken the gloves off. It began during the hearings last week with his nominee. His new approach is raising eyebrows and gaining attention, both favorable and unfavorable. It began in the waning hours of the hearing and continued into this week. On Wednesday, he was at the Atlantic Festival in Washington, where his defense of Kavanaugh drew boos.
I thought she was handled respectfully. I thought Kavanaugh was treated like crap. Yeah, well, boo yourself. Here's what
all
I
right,
think.
All right.
I've never heard a senator say any of that. All four of the senators from the Carolinas are Republicans. Why is he the most vocal?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about why he's the most vocal. I think the sort of ultimate anti-Trump version is that he wants Jeff Sessions' job and he is rehearsing for it on the biggest stage. There are plenty of other people who say that Lindsey Graham is finally acting like the conservative they always hoped he would be. Newt Gingrich went on Fox News this week and said, I think that moment justified Lindsey Graham's entire career. So whatever the reason, this is resonating big time with conservatives, and I suspect that Senator Graham probably knew it would.
And it's the combative nature of his character which seems to have changed, because on Wednesday, while he was taking questions at that Atlantic Festival from a guy named Jeffrey Goldberg, who is the editor-in-chief of that publication, he became combative yet again when asked about his reaction to President Trump mocking Christine Blasey Ford's memory gaps.
So President Trump went through a factual rendition that I didn't particularly like, and I would tell him, knock it off. You're not helping, but it can be worse. You can actually kill somebody's cat and puncture their tires to get them to shut up. So, you know, what he said.
I don't even understand what that means.
Well, you don't remember Kathleen Willie and Juanita Broderick, so you don't. I do.
Well, I don't remember the thing about the cat, but what's the point?
Well,
the point is that Donald Trump could have said something even worse, so we should be thankful.
The point is that we've come a long way. We've come a long way since 1990.
All right, it's fine.
Whether you like it or not, I really don't care.
Is this a new approach, or has this always been lurking under the surface?
Politicians do a lot of internal polling, and I don't have any proof, but you know, I suspect he has done some polling. He runs for re-election in 2020, mm-hmm. and I think he knows he's in trouble.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Go ahead.
Just going to say that his esteem among South Carolina Republicans has risen greatly through this. So perhaps it's the result of him paying attention to polls, but the effect of that is that a lot of South Carolina Republicans who were suspicious of him in the past have changed their tune, as Eric was mentioning.
And again, it's been fascinating that the style of communication has become as much a part of the issue as what they're saying. I think there were people who watched the way that Kavanaugh and Lindsey Graham spoke and saw somebody being manly in a good sense, being forceful for the truth, you know, being a leader. And there were people that saw those same styles and saw privileged white guys lashing out, bullying, ranting. And certainly for women who have been accused of being too emotional if they show the tiniest bit of emotion, or African Americans who are always being accused of being angry, I think there's a lot out there in the cultural mix.
Suggesting
that we're struggling
all
with.
Rules don't apply evenly?
I think that could be the case.
I think that might be the point of the day right there. I think you just hit it very accurately.
Senator Graham also appeared, I think it was on Sean Hannity's program earlier this week, with a warning to Democrats, and by extraction any senator, who might vote no today on this nomination.
I would renominate him, and I would take this case to the American people, and I'd ask voters in Indiana and Missouri and North Dakota and other places where Trump won, and see if the voters want to appeal the verdict of their senator.
But his position on Judge Kavanaugh, who some have said lied, as we've just talked about, to the Senate about his past behavior, does not square with what he said in 1999. I think you brought this up, Glenn, as a member of the House, when he was at the head of the group of Republicans set on bringing down President Clinton for having lied about his affair with Monica Lewinsky. He then said, lying rose to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor, which, of course, is the definition you have to apply if you're going to impeach someone, and that lying under oath merited removal for any high-level government official, and he argued it this way in 1999 when he took his case to the Senate.
I have argued to you that when you found that a judge was a perjurer, you couldn't in good conscience send him back in a courtroom, because everybody that came in that courtroom thereafter would have a real serious doubt.
Do politicians not know that things get recorded and played back?
Not know or not care?
Well, seriously.
I mean, you know, how many years did, I'm just going to cite one example, how many years did Tim Russert bring people onto the set of Meet the Press and play back the comments? And I think they just realized that people have short memories.
But flip-flopping used to be a bad thing. I remember that distinctly. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with David Borax from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and from QCityMetro.com, its editor and publisher, Glenn Birkins. I don't know how you have time to be here.
It's not easy.
It's not, I know. On Wednesday, 23-year-old former UNC Charlotte 49er quarterback Kevin Olsen was found not guilty of rape charges. Was that expected?
I don't know if there was an expectation coming into this of how it was going to be settled. I mean, I think from the coverage, I wasn't in the courtroom, the coverage, though, it was highly emotional on both sides.
My colleague Sarah D'Elia covered the trial every day, and she talked about how much of the trial was taken up by concerns about text messages between them, not all of which were favorable to the prosecution side on this. There were some texts in which the accuser kind of backed away from the idea that it was rape. There was another accusation that she made, or a comment to a friend where she said that she was going to ruin his life. They were in a relationship, which makes this one of those really difficult to prove rape cases. There was violence. There was a beating that night and all that. So I think, from the standpoint of the accuser, I think she probably was kind of surprised and disappointed at that. But if you looked at the testimony and the fact that they did not put Kevin Olsen on the stand, I think that was a strategy that worked for the defense on that one. That makes, for me at least, not the biggest surprise that he was acquitted.
Does anyone know why he was not charged in the beating? Because it seems like that was a crime that he pretty clearly did from all the testimony. And I have not had a chance to ask our court reporter, but that kind of struck me throughout was, if he just beat her, that's still a crime.
Yeah, well, and the other thing that, and you heard the defense attorney mention this, the fact that you had no college-age women on that jury, and only three women total on the jury, also probably played a large role.
For a while, it seemed that the jury was having a tough time coming to a decision. I know they came back to the judge at least once and asked about what would happen if they couldn't reach a decision or if there was a hung jury. I think the vote was 10-2 at the time in favor of Olsen, and the judge said no. You have to reach a decision.
Your duty as jurors is to come back with a verdict. And they went back, and I think it was an hour or an hour and a half later, they came back with the not guilty verdicts. Mm.
So there were two recalcitrant jurors who had to be convinced. I would love to have been a fly on the wall to see how that came about. So we knew that the Republican convention, we've known for a while that the Republican National Convention in 2020 will be here. Now we have the dates for that convention, which are?
August 24th through August 27th.
That seems short to me.
4 days.
That seems short to me.
And there will be some wind-up to it.
The circus will last much longer than that.
That's about what the DNC was, right?
Don't worry, Mike. We'll have you – no vacation time for you in August of 2020.
I've already blocked it out.
You'll have plenty
to do. I'll be in Myrtle Beach. No, I'm just kidding. Although
– might be easier to get a hotel room
Airbnb
there than
in
here.
Your house, right?
Maybe not. They'll be commuting from there. Although Mayor Vi Lyles seemed to have very little opposition when she began her quest for this, and in fact – I think polled city council and nobody was terribly opposed to it until it became apparent that we were going to get it. Yep. And then some people came from the woodwork. City Councilman Braxton Winston called the presumptive nominee of the convention, Donald Trump, an avatar of white supremacy. Has that opposition died down at all since that?
No, but what was interesting is that, they had the press conference on Monday, I believe it was, and Braxton Winston was among the attendees. He was there with his colleagues, Tark Bakari, Larkin Eggleston, and Ed Driggs, and he was saying, now it's here. We have to go ahead and figure out how to do this. I think there's still plenty of opposition. I think there will be all the way through the conclusion of the convention. So that's not going to change. What's interesting to me is that Mayor Vi Lyles continues to receive nothing but plaudits from every Republican leader out there. So, at least with Republican voters, it looks like she's in good shape, and I assume some Democrats are maybe mixed.
Remember why cities want to host conventions like this. There's got to be some benefit, and I think to Vi Lyles, she sees great benefits for it, for all the reasons why we like conventions. It brings attention to the city, jobs, and that sort of thing. I think we may have seen some of those, like Braxton Winston being at that, because one of his big concerns is this actually should benefit Charlotteans. And he's a stagehand, and he's complained during the run-up to the vote by the city council that stagehands weren't being treated fairly and that some of the jobs were going to people from outside the area. So I think he may be there to kind of be a watchdog on this.
And just to be clear, conventions, they do add a temporary boost, but it's not anything permanent.
But it's hundreds of millions. It's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, right. I don't diminish that. I'm just saying it's not a you don't host a convention and it doesn't provide a permanent boost to the economy.
Of course not.
And a lot of those jobs don't go to the people who are actually most in need of those jobs, too. I think we have to keep that in mind. I think the biggest threat to Mayor Lyles is going to be re-election, and we'll have to see how that plays out.
Because she was in favor of this or because of potential violence during it?
She will face election before that. Because of the opposition.
Okay.
There is a lot of anger, a lot of resentment in the African American community. Whether that will translate into voting and how they vote, that's yet to be seen. But she did not. There was a lot of opposition to her inviting this convention here.
And part of what comes in and stays is the money for security, policing, and I think there is a lingering sense that some of what came in during the DNC stayed around and came back in a rather malignant form during the uprising a couple of years ago. So I think there's going to be, as we lead up to this, some people saying, we want more disclosure of what the police are doing. And the police right now are saying, we don't give away our security strategy in advance.
So there's $50 million in aid from the federal government on this. And it hasn't gotten a lot of coverage, but there's been this back scene, behind the scenes email blast from folks who oppose this and back and forth between city officials and the police and these folks who are saying, we want to know what the money's being spent on. We want to know what devices you're going to use against us is kind of the attitude that they're
taking. They getting the same kind of reaction when the Democrats came here with similar amounts of money from the federal government?
It was
also kept secret.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, the circumstances were alike. I don't remember as much pushback, and I think that's because so much has changed in the past 6 years in terms of what we know about and what has happened.
And back then, we didn't know what we didn't know.
Right. And, 2 years ago with the protests after the shooting of Keith Scott, one of the things that protesters were seizing on was they saw all of this equipment out there being used against protesters, and they said, wait a minute, you know, is this why we have this? And so now that is a hot-button issue for them.
The other thing that I think needs to be mentioned again when we talk about the convention is there's the money piece that you mentioned, Mike, but the overwhelming theme among organizers and civic boosters is the fact that you get this huge spotlight, you get all this attention, you have essentially a two-week commercial, and there is the mixed feeling about, well, what if something goes wrong, or what if it is a particularly negative convention, then what kind of damage have you done, and how do you clean that up?
Do people really connect that to a city?
Chicago, 1968? I mean,
no.
You just say that.
But that was the way Mayor Daley handled it. They didn't associate the riots in the street necessarily with Chicago until the police in Chicago turned it into a melee.
What I'm saying is, for whatever reason, if there is something that goes wrong,
right,
you have to deal with that. And so
it will drown out, and it will drown out any positive message.
Correct.
So if Mayor Lyles is going to face a stiff opposition because she reached across the aisle to Republicans to bring in economic development dollars, that means you can't reach across the aisle in any direction at any time going forward. So if that is the case, if that's where we are in this country, and it clearly is, you can't govern the country.
Well, that's a little bit of a straw man argument. If you say that because she supported the Republican National Convention, she can never reach across the aisle.
That's what I'm saying is she reached across the aisle to bring it in, and people are ticked off about it.
I think you can't do that.
What can you do?
Well, I also think it's about this particular president. I think if it were any other president, we wouldn't be having this discussion. I think it's about this president who is not viewed favorably by many African Americans, to put it mildly. I'm not predicting she will face stiff opposition, but I talk to enough people and I hear enough to know that there is widespread dissatisfaction with her role.
Well, she'll be on this program with her annual or her monthly visit next Thursday. We'll ask her about that.
One more thing about the convention before we move on. The rather large echo chamber that I'm part of people who work for or have students in CMS, those dates immediately raised eyebrows because August 24th is when based on the state's calendar law, would be the most logical time to open schools. So
they won't open schools.
The school board is now going to have to look at either opening as all of this converges just seems virtually impossible, or they're going to have to push it back to either that Friday or the next Monday, which then, because the state law kind of gives you this pretty tight window, is going to create problems. So I think you're going to hear a lot more about why the state should not be telling schools when to open and close.
And the convention has to be there because the Democrats are holding their convention, I think, in June?
July 13th through the 16th.
And then it's the Olympics.
Yeah, although it is interesting, Mike, there's at least a week between the Democratic convention and then you go to the Olympics for 2 weeks. I mean, there are other times in there, but it's set, so there's no one doing it now.
So if you want a hotel room in Charlotte between August 24th through 27th, you better book fast. I'm told that there are these numbers don't make sense to me, and you're the number guy. You're the senior money writer over there.
I got to go.
Charlotte Business Journal. They say that there are reservations for 17,000 hotel rooms already. And they say that that is two-thirds of the available rooms. The Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority reported that, but they also reported that the area has 30,000 hotel rooms. Now, if I've done the math right, 17,000 is not two-thirds of 30. It's like a little over half.
Yeah, I think they were probably being optimistic in chamber visitor tourism terms.
Well, it may depend how wide you draw the circle.
Yeah, most of the hotels.
County, baby, we're going to get.
So yeah, somebody told me this week that the majority of the hotel rooms that are being used are within an 11-mile radius of uptown.
So when they say 30,000, they're going way out to Concord and places like that. Now there'll be
that's your hotel.
Won't there be a couple of new hotels downtown?
Yes, there will.
Are they counting those in the figures? Those rooms?
I don't know if they're counting those in. I don't know if you can book the rooms before the hotel is physically built. I guess you could, but I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. The General Assembly has decided to earmark $50 million in Hurricane Florence funds. How quickly will that money be released, and how will it be spent?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking somebody to say,
I don't know the exact moment.
When's the money going to be released, and how much is it? And where's it going to go?
I know that it's the $56.5 million. $6.5 million is for the school employees who would otherwise not be paid. The other $50 million is for basically everything else involved with relief.
Yeah, $6.5 million is going to school teachers who can't work, who couldn't work because schools were closed for the hurricane. And evidently, if you don't work, you don't get paid in schools. Is that how it works? Really?
Well, originally, that you might end up having to take leave days.
If there's no school?
Charlotte, yeah, there's an
elaborate system. If there's no school building to go to, they're going to take your money away?
Well, apparently they're not. In just a general, you know, if there's a snowstorm and they close for a day or two, they may say, you know, it's an optional work day, which might mean you could come in, that depending on how dangerous. If it's truly dangerous, it is a mandatory work day, and then you either might not get paid or you take a leave day. And that, of course, is not popular with people who are saying, I've already planned my leave days for vacations and I desperately need them. And now, and especially if you're a fairly new teacher who hasn't built up a lot of time, that can really cut into it.
So the legislature also issued waivers for school systems that will not now hit the minimum 185 school days because of flooding. They're not going to make them make those days up. Is that correct?
That's my understanding of it, and I have not heard a detailed discussion of how that will play out in Charlotte-Mecklenburg or this area. We, of course, are not disaster zone counties, but I believe it will give some flexibility. And again, Charlotte-Mecklenburg had already said it was not going to make up the 3 days it took, which only becomes an issue if you then start having a lot of winter closings.
And remember, Mike, this is sort of the first stab at it. They will come back, the legislature will come back in 2 weeks, and you're already hearing lawmakers saying that there will be several waves of funds approved. Remember, there's a $2 billion rainy day fund, and so you're already hearing, on the one hand, the legislators and the governor say, we're going to do what it takes, and you're seeing some groups out there saying, you need to do more, you've got the money, why don't you go ahead
and
do
it? Well, they do, and they're talking about $1 billion needed for this, and there's $2 billion in the rainy day fund. Are they liable to spend half of it on Hurricane Florence?
They may well do that, but there's money from multiple sources. I mean, we're not counting in here the federal funds that'll be coming, and who knows if that'll be $500 million or $1 billion. You know, the needs are so many. So you asked before, what are they going to spend it on? I mean, the first $56 million will be, you know, people will apply for that, and it'll be everything from local road repairs to state road repairs. pay some of the expenses of responding to the storm. There are so many little pieces of this that this will be going on for years, as it is still going on for Hurricane Matthew just 2 years ago. I mean, let's not forget that the recovery for that is still ongoing and money was still being dispersed by the state for that. This is going to get very complicated.
I'm not sure they're not still dispersing money from Sandy, that went up the East Coast. Hmm.
Yeah.
And Governor Cooper says his administration is working hard to push recovery forward.
We're in overdrive right now in assessing damages, in gathering information, in looking what the available federal programs are for us, how state government can fill in the gaps, and how we can make everything work together.
And he also says that he hopes recovery will include more buyouts than past efforts, citing the fact that North Carolina has experienced two 500-year storms, Florence this time around, Matthew in 2016, in less than 2 years. Are people going to be opened to property buyouts and not rebuilding their beach homes, et cetera?
Well, I think when it comes to the big fancy beach homes, people are going to want to rebuild those, and they'll figure out a way to do it. They will resist being bought out because there's this fight that's going on about whether you should be able to build that close to the water. I think in other areas, like the low-lying areas along the rivers that where the flooding was the worst inland, I think there needs to be some receptivity to that, and there will be because people have suffered this, not just these two storms, but other storms in recent years. And, you know, let's think about moving some of those communities and some of that housing to another place.
And you did hear some victims saying, look, I just got through trying to clean up from the last one and now this one. And there was a sense, at least among some, that they would be willing to look at
living elsewhere. Unlike the beaches, those people don't live there because they want to. They live there because that was what they could afford.
So the legislature is coming back into session on October the 15th, and among the things they've already decided is to allow a delay in voter registration in affected areas, empowering local elections boards to move voting sites if access to those locations has been damaged by flooding. They're also waiving DMV fees for people who need to replace their driver's licenses lost in the flood. They're coming back on October the 15th to decide on further spending. And when we come back from the break, there are just a couple of more things I want to touch on. Among them, the size of the mosquitoes that have developed because of the ongoing flood conditions in certain parts of the state. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. As Andos Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins is here from QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And David Borax from our news department at WFAE News. One of the lingering after effects of Hurricane Florence was all the water left behind, which, of course, is a perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes. One Fayetteville resident, Cassie Vidovsky, posted a Facebook video of mosquitoes literally swarming her car.
This is what we deal with. I just pulled up from picking Alan up from school. Look at them. They're all over the window, just waiting. Alan, don't open the door yet, okay?
Why?
Because I gotta be prepared to get us out of the car very, very fast.
USA Today called this an outbreak and described these mosquitoes as, quote, bloodthirsty, aggressive, and monstrous pests. Sounds like it's out of 1865.
Coming soon to a theater near you.
And Mecklenburg and Mecklenburg County Senior Environmental Specialist James Bjornebo says complaints about these insects is four times the normal volume for this time of year.
They're big mosquitoes. They'll bite through your shirt. Generally speaking, all the mosquitoes in that genus are kind of heavy, chunkier mosquitoes. and you tend to see them in floodplain type areas.
So these bugs, as he just said, will bite through your shirt. They're about the size of a nickel.
Car. They're size of a Buick. Let's not mince words here.
That's right. But the good news is that they don't carry disease, which is interesting. Where do they come from? I mean, if this is a new phenomenon, where have they been?
Well, actually, I learned a lot about mosquitoes doing the story this week, and it turns out that mosquito eggs are present in the environment at all times.
That's comforting.
When water comes up like this, and if it comes up to higher levels than normal, the eggs hatch into larvae, and within 5 to 7 days, you've got mosquitoes. And the ones that Bjornebo was talking about are called Saurophora or Gallinipper mosquitoes. Those are the big ones. And they are in larger numbers, and all mosquitoes are in larger numbers right now. I mean, even the little tiger mosquitoes in the backyard. But these particular ones, which the Observer referred to as monsters, are out, and we're feeling the effects of them.
But do we see them normally, but just in smaller numbers, these big mosquitoes?
So in smaller numbers and not necessarily in the places we're seeing them now, because remember, the waters came up higher, so their range now is a little expanded because of this flooding.
And we sure don't seem to be getting any cold weather that would kill them off either. So.
That's WFAE correspondent Bill Nye. All right.
Well, this is a question for you because this is right in your wheelhouse, David. The Waterkeeper Alliance and Earth Justice report that the water near Duke Energy's flooded ash ponds near Wilmington is, quote, insanely toxic, with arsenic levels 71 times higher than the state's drinking water standard. Duke Energy has dismissed that claim as outrageous and designed to promote an, quote, extreme agenda. Who do we believe?
Well, this is clearly a case of battling science here. And, you know, there's lots of discussion about where did they take the samples? When did they take them? The Waterkeeper took samples, you know, during and right after the flooding. Some of the samples that were taken by the state and Duke were taken later and in different areas. The Waterkeeper folks are arguing that Duke's samples were not taken at a low enough depth to really capture what's in the water. I'm not going to take sides on this except to observe that this debate is not going to go away and that it's an extension of a debate we've been having for years about the presence of coal ash in the environment around here.
If in fact it is true, we don't know that it necessarily is, but if in fact it is true that arsenic levels are 71 times higher than the state normally allows, what is the source of the arsenic?
So arsenic is present in coal ash, which is left after
burning
coal.
So why then does the federal government not say that coal ash is toxic? They will not classify it as a hazardous substance. Why?
That's a great question, Mike, and I don't know the answer to that, except that there's been an attempt, I think, by government to balance the fact that this stuff exists with the potential damage that it could cause and the toxicity of it. It is true that in low levels, this stuff is not a problem, and in many places, it is not in concentrations high enough to cause people to worry. The question is about long-term exposure to this. And, you know, right now we've got this flooding that's causing the numbers to spike. If that were to stay that way for a while, I think it would be a big concern. And that's why the Waterkeepers are raising it, is not so much that they think people are going to start dropping dead from this, but that it highlights the problem that's been there for years and is likely to be here for a long time after. And, you know, not to get too deeply into this subject, but the debate right now is over whether companies like Duke should be required to dig up the existing coal ash and move it to more secure lined landfills. That's what the environmentalists would like to see. Duke is saying, look, we got, you know, 120 million tons of this stuff. We couldn't possibly move it all. It's not that dangerous. And the Duke is able to rest on the fact that there is no federal standard for this right now. And I'm not sure if that's going to change anytime
soon. Well, they are moving it. We've done several programs on this. They are moving this coal ash in South Carolina.
That's right.
And in other places. But to move the amount of coal ash, evidently, that has been accumulating since the early 1900s.
Yeah, maybe 100 years.
It would take a very, very long time and a steady stream of dump trucks 24 hours a day in a line like a train for years.
Not to mention the cost and who bears the cost. I was just going to ask a question, actually, David, because I know you follow this closely. Wasn't the State Department of Environmental Quality, weren't their tests similar to what Duke found?
Yeah, I'm kind of lumping them into the same bucket here. they came out with within the last 48 hours with their tests and said it doesn't look like they've exceeded any standards here. And basically, they confirmed what Duke said. And of course, if you're sitting on the Waterkeeper Alliance saying, you're saying, whoa, this is very fishy that these are coming out the same. But, you know, they're going to keep battling over this.
So we're going to bring up something we haven't talked about in a long time, but this time it's HB 2.0. This week, a federal judge partially dismissed an attempt by six LGBT North Carolinians and their attorneys to overturn the law that replaced HB 2, which is HB 142. But despite that, civil rights groups are celebrating this development. Why? It seems like they were defeated, but no, it's not the case.
Because they can still challenge the law, correctly?
Two things. Yeah. They can still challenge. There's a piece of the law that's left. That's the one that bars local communities from passing their own anti-discrimination laws. So they can still challenge that. That will go forward. But they're also celebrating it because the judge said there's nothing in North Carolina law that dictates where a transgender person can go to the bathroom. And so they like the sound of that. They're saying that that vindicates their cause. I will say that the conservatives, and maybe, Eric, you can speak to this a little bit, but conservatives are saying, well, wait a minute, there are laws. And so now there's a discussion about that. Tammy Fitzgerald, yeah.
Yes, there is a discussion about that. But I was also going to say, one of the things that's really interesting about this is, remember, HB 142, which replaced your favorite law, HB 2, because you like to say HB 2 over and over, when part of the compromise was, of course, that they would not have these non-discrimination ordinances until 2020. That was a key piece of reaching consensus. So if this is now challenged, right, you run the great risk of sort of starting the whole fight anew.
Over again. And this judge, this federal judge, was a George W. Bush appointee.
Correct.
So just want everybody to know that. You never know what's going to happen with the judge, right?
You never know.
The research team that released the survey that labeled Charlotte as the worst in this country's 50 biggest cities for upward social mobility has signed on now to work with the city's public and private officials on changing that. So what are they going to do?
Well, they have created a huge database that pulls in data from the IRS, from the Census Bureau, and they are going to be primarily, I think, contributing data to the research that Charlotte will then be bringing in local feedback from the ground, newer data. So it is a big tool that is now accessible to anybody who wants to log on to it, and you can look up your little neighborhood and you can see what they've tracked about these young people who were born, I think, in the 70s and 80s, and how they have fared. You can see, are the outcomes significantly different by race or by what level of income they were born into? So it's kind of, right now, I think it's a big curiosity factor, and it is a big infusion of expertise and of money that has come in from some of these biggest foundations, like the Gates Foundation.
A fellow named Raj Chetty was the lead author of the study that threw us into a tizzy here, and he heads this new nonprofit called Opportunity Insights. David Williams is the policy director for Opportunity Insights Charlotte, the Charlotte Project. He says the original study unmasked a reality hidden by growth and prosperity, that the organization brings with them this data that you referred to identify where the problems are. And former Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and North Carolina Teacher of the Year James Ford is the Charlotte co-chair of this effort.
We may assume because the area is affluent, like that's a high opportunity area, when the truth is that may not be a high opportunity area according to all the metrics that we're looking at. So this permits us to start making really smart and really intentional decisions so that 20, 30 years down the line, we can look and say, yeah, that was the right call.
So they want to make a dent in this by the time the Republican National Convention arrives in 2020. Is that possible? Can you turn this around in that amount of time?
Go ahead. Turn it around,
I doubt it. I doubt if you can turn it around. I think you can make some strides toward addressing it. These are systemic problems. These aren't problems. These problems predate everyone around this table. And you're not going to make significant progress at addressing those problems in 2 years. What we can do in 2 years is start to put systems in place where we can address those problems eventually down the road. But
are you talking, when you're talking about putting systems in place, are you talking about social services? Are you talking about Charlotte?
I'm talking about
schools. What are you talking
about?
All
of the things they've talked about in that report, early childhood, education, health care, those types of things.
But they've just released how much money? 600 slots for pre-K, right?
Right.
And they can't fill them. Nobody's coming forward.
Oh, you have to ask Ann about that.
I haven't done an update in the last week or two, but that was rather baffling. Yes. I mean, there is still a wait list for subsidized child care, so this is very complicated. And I think to the extent that there is some pushback on this, hooray for this big Harvard research project, it is, you know, when do we quit throwing lots and lots of money at research and at experts and at people who want to process and translate what the people who are actually living in these neighborhoods need and actually start doing for something and listening to the people in the neighborhoods.
But if the people in the neighborhoods don't come forward when the solution is presented, or at least one part of a solution is presented, what can you do about it?
Well, and I think that goes to my point that these are long-term systemic problems. And a lot of times people who are living in these neighborhoods aren't aware, of what they need or what they might not need.
Or even the availability.
What about the skepticism of people who may be in need and have seen these efforts and then they come to nothing and they may be a little hesitant to sort of jump in immediately? One thing that I'd be curious to hear your opinion on this, Glenn, is the fact that 2-year time window, that's a little bit of a danger sign, I think, because then you get to 2020 in the convention, you say this is great, and then where do you go from there?
Well, I hope that this isn't just about doing something before the convention. I would hope that there is a true long-term commitment to solving this problem.
Now, that was certainly what I heard from Brian Collier with the Foundation for the Carolinas, who was the one very much talking up this, you know, we want to, when the nation's eyes turn to us, we want to be looked at as a city that is working on solutions as opposed to just the city that's the worst. He didn't indicate that we would have it all solved.
So you reported this week, Ann, on something else that took place in the state. We talk a lot about our broken schools, and we've talked about all the problems in these schools for years now, but you wrote about a visit by education writer Nicole Hannah-Jones, who told people listening that our schools are not broken. Our schools are operating exactly the way they were designed. Talk about that.
Well, and what she said is that the way they were designed is to perpetuate a racial caste system. And she traced this all the way back to the history of slavery, when it was literally against the law and black people were killed and tortured for trying to learn to read, to this history of segregated schools where the black children always got less. And she showed pictures that any of us who have been in schools would recognize of classrooms where every face is black or brown, and said things have not changed all this much. You know, we have this elaborate system of saying, well, maybe those people just don't value an education, or, well, gosh, it's just an artifact of where people live. And she said, no, this is policy. This is our country. You know, racism is not a feature. It is in our DNA.
And it kind of ties into the program we did yesterday about advanced placement, which we're doing a series on here with WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn, and you can go to our website and hear that series about when advanced placement classes, when you challenge young people who you think are just average, they will reach the heights. They will take your challenge, and they will meet your expectations. But if you have low expectations, that's where they'll stay.
And that's part of what Nicole Hannah-Jones was talking about. She told a story about a young woman who had excelled, who had just been outstanding in an all-black school, and I don't remember what state, it was not North Carolina, but then took her ACTs and couldn't pass, couldn't get into a good college. So she is saying that we all, when we choose the opportunity and give it up for someone else, we are perpetuating that system.
So before we leave, we need to talk about the Panthers, because they've hired somebody will raise some eyebrows, Eric Reed. He's one of the top free agents in the country. Experts were saying that the Panthers stuck to football when they made this decision, because he's also the second person to kneel next to Colin Kaepernick when they were both 49ers. At a press conference, Reed did not appear concerned whether his social justice activity rubs fans the wrong way.
As we said when we started, Colin and I, nothing will change unless you talk about it. So we're going to continue to talk about it. We're going to continue to hold America to the standard that it says on paper, that we're all created equal, because it's not that way right now. But we're going to keep pushing towards that.
Cam has said he will stick by Reed. This is something that people say would never have happened under Jerry Richardson. Is this a sign of a new day, a new team?
I think it's a sign of a new day. Definitely different ownership. This, I do not think, would have happened under Jerry Richardson.
And he's that good?
He's really good, so we'll find out on Sunday if he lives up to the billing. But, yeah, he's pretty good.
All righty. That's Eric Spanberg, who gets the last word today from the Charlotte Business Journal. Glenn Berkins is here from Queen City, QCityMetro.com. And Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer and David Borax from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.